Alton Brown. You're listening to the Alton Brown Cast. We're recording today in Charleston, South Carolina, where resides one Brooks Wrights. Are you from here?
From Kentucky.
You're from Kentucky?
Yes.
But you've moved here. Mm-hmm. Brooks runs a company called Jack Rudy, which makes very interesting elixirs. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm going to say. Start by talking about your current line of products that you actually make here in Charleston.
Yes, right? Yeah, we make them not far from here where we are in North Charleston. And we produce non-alcoholic cocktail mixers. And we take our inspiration from sort of forgotten mixers in the American bar canon that maybe our parents or grandparents would have consumed that were sort of changed over the course of the years to make them, you know, production easier and maybe cheaper and using ingredients maybe that people like you and I don't want to drink. So high fructose corn syrup.
Talking about mixers that have been dumbed down considerably
exactly.
For the sake of price and marketing and not quality.
Mm-hmm. And so we've sort of identify those and then think about how we can reinvent them and make them interesting again for a new audience that maybe hasn't been exposed to them.
I discovered you through your tonic.
Mm-hmm.
I guess syrup is technically what
it is.
It's a tonic syrup. Because I'm a very big fan of gin and tonic, and I had somebody turn me on to this little medicine bottle that was very cool looking. And folks, if you haven't had the Jack Rudy tonic, you mix it. What I do is two jiggers of gin, one jigger of this syrup, and then just ice and top it off with club soda, and it makes its own tonic water. Tell me how this came to be.
Yeah.
Because this is wacky thinking.
It is wacky thinking. And really the whole project, the reason syrup was the first approach was because I didn't have money to or know-how to produce a carbonated beverage. So most people are used to going in and buying tonic at the store and they
sure,
pop
tonic
it open.
Water.
And
water.
Yeah. And then it loses its fizz fairly quickly. Well, now, you know, so I didn't have the money or the know-how to produce that kind of beverage. So I was a big gin fan as well. I was working at a place in Kentucky, and we had a really great bar and a ton of beautiful gins I had never been exposed to. This was mm-hmm. fresh out of college.
What are some examples of things that really blew your mind back
then?
Oh,
I mean, even at that stage, I had never seen Plymouth gin before, which I came to love.
Sure.
Hendrick's was, you know, beginning to be a little more common at bars around the country. Things like Corsair from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these American craft spirits, the products that St. George makes, the Junipero and whatnot. So I began to see all this new world of gins. And I was the general manager of this restaurant, and we would serve gin and tonic, which is, of course, such a popular drink. And we would pour this beautiful, well-crafted, you know, artisanal gin. And then we would turn and we would pop our supermarket tonic water. And it just occurred to me that there had to be a better way, you know?
And nobody was really making, was this before any of the craft tonics like Fever Tree or anybody came out?
You know, I think it was, Q came out soon after that. Mm-hmm. And then Fever Tree I had maybe heard about, but it wasn't available in the States yet. And I even tried to track it down and couldn't. So I said, well, then I'll make my own.
Was there an actual moment when you're like, you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm always interested in that moment where somebody decides to do something that other people would not dare do.
Well, it was born not for a business, you know. It was just a sort of selfish thing that I wanted to produce because I thought it'd be cool. So I think the moment maybe was where I maybe tried to track down Fever Tree and found that no one was importing it to the States yet, or if they were, maybe it was only available in New York and it just financially didn't make sense to buy for the restaurant. And I think at that point is when I said, I'm going to just make my own. I can figure it out. You know, Google is at my fingertips. And that's really what I did. I just started to research online, reading message boards and whatnot. And come to find out, you know, I wasn't the first guy ever to produce a tonic. You know, there were, quote unquote, you know, the cocktail nerds who were tooling around in their kitchens. And, you know, and I was one of those. So I learned about that process, started producing it at the restaurant in the kitchen and serving it there. Now that product that I was making, it used to be much, much more complex, a lot more stuff in it. And as time went on, I realized there was sort of beauty in the simplicity of extracting, you know, these things like allspice and clove and these sort of wintry spices I had in it in the long time ago. And so I sort of that I always felt like that stood in the way of the gin. So just sort of started subtracting, and people really loved it. The restaurant, it was very popular. They actually still serve a house-made tonic to this day. It's sort of the original recipe that I had formulated. It's not the Jack Rudy that I have in a bottle today, but people loved it, and that was sort of the beginning. And I didn't think at that time, oh, I should bottle this and sell it. That was never a thought.
Tell me about those first batches. What were the ingredients that you knew had to be there for a tonic to be tonic?
Sure. Well, the main one was quinine, which is the bark of a tree, grows primarily in Peru. It is the cinchona tree.
Cinchona tree. You sent me some bark. You sent me some cinchona bark.
Uh-huh. So that's what I was working with, of course, was the cinchona.
That translates to fever tree. It's
roughly,
yeah, that's what that word means, basically, because the Indians drank it as a cure for fevers.
I did not know
that. So they called
that.
It the fever tree. Cinchona means fever tree.
Oh, cool. Well, then, smart branding on
that
part.
Yeah, good branding on that part. How did you even get that in the beginning? Because, I mean, cinchona, it's not an easy bark to get hold of.
No, and it's gotten very hard.
Because of demand?
I think so, yeah. And there are now several more craft tonics on the market. We have a few friendly competitors that are producing tonic syrups. I'm happy to say, you know, I feel like we were the first one to occupy that.
First I ever saw.
That mixer space, yeah. Which is now, it's so funny because it was... Because I did it out of the lack of funding, but now tonic syrup is a certifiable mixer category, you know, and there are 3, 4, 5 that you could go out
and
find.
Anybody ever thank you for inventing it?
I've never gotten an official thanks.
Well,
no.
I'll thank you on part of the Cocktail Drinkers America. Thank you very much for
Absolutely.
Inventing for tonic syrup.
I accept.
I'm going to make you a trophy.
Very good. Well, so quinine is the number one thing. And then from there, I knew citrus needed to be a part of it. And then just what other flavorings I thought could introduce, you know, sort of a spices that might accent the botanicals that you would find in gin. And that was the first light bulb.
And did you, in for these original batches, did you have a preferred gin? Is there like one gin that you're like, this is the one that I'm basing all of my work on?
Absolutely. And I love all gins, and I try not to have any sort of brand allegiance.
Of course.
But my grandmother drank Beefeater, and I think that, you know, Beefeater is, for me, the classic London dry gin.
Yes.
And it's what I drink quite often at home. I mean, I have a very large home bar, as I'm sure you do. But Beefeater's what I find myself going back to. I use it sort of as the benchmark gin.
I'm a big fan of Beefeater 24.
Is that the one with grapefruit
no,
peel?
No, it is a more refined version of a London Dry. It's kind of like their top drawer London Dry. They put a little bit more time and attention to it. An English friend of mine, Simon Majumdar, turned me on to it. But no, it's not flavored
at
all. The bottom of the bottle is kind of reddish.
Maybe that's what
I'm
thinking of.
It's got a red faded line, but the gin itself is pure London Dry. To me, the finest London Dry that there is.
Awesome. I'll have to track that
down. You should.
I think Tanqueray 10 is another one. Like, I think Tanqueray makes sort of their high-end
same
version.
Same kind of. Yep.
Which I imagine to be similar. Yeah. Yep.
So what year was this? What batch one was when?
Batch one would have been, I don't know, maybe 2007, maybe?
Okay.
Sounds about right.
So you're making it in small batches in the kitchen at the restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and serving it at the restaurant.
Okay, so when did all of a sudden it strike your head that, maybe I should put this in bottles, name it after my grandfather, and sell it?
That happened several years later. That was in Kentucky. I moved to Charleston.
Why?
Family. I have a 5-year-old son, and he was born here. So I moved here right before he was born. And, of course, also a huge draw was the food and beverage scene, which has continued to just explode. It's really a special place in our industry. So I moved here and started working at a great place called Fig, which is downtown Charleston. And I moved because of, you know, some of my previous experience, moved into sort of a beverage manager role and was sort of tasked with reinventing the bar program there. Of course, the chef, Mike Latta, is insanely talented. But at that time, the bar had maybe been slightly overlooked. And because Charleston, for the longest time, served airplane bottles. So you really couldn't have a quote-unquote cocktail program. But I came on board and started making the tonic again. I just knew we had had good success with it in Kentucky. So I said, well, I'm going to make this tonic. We did a daily cocktail that I started. We put a chalkboard up, and we would just do a new cocktail every day, which was a great way to sort of gain the trust of our customers. And I did a gin and homemade tonic at that time, not any sort of brand name, just house-made, you know, tonic was what we called it. And people really loved it. Again, the main difference for Charleston is we have a huge tourist trade, or we have a big tourist clientele.
A lot of folks.
And a lot of them come for the food, and they like to take home a piece of Charleston. So what I found was a lot of these guests would be coming in, and they would say, I love this tonic. It's the best I've ever had. You know, the best compliment is when someone who's been drinking gin and tonics for 40 years tells me it's their favorite. So that started to happen, and they asked if they could buy it to take home. And I would, you know, pack it up in a little quart container from, you know, the restaurant to go container and just give it to them because, of course, I was so excited that someone loved it. And then that was the seed. It was at that moment after maybe 6, 7, 8 people asked to buy some to take home. I thought, well, you know what? I don't have a ton of free time, but that would be cool to go through the process of creating a brand and telling a story and packaging this and selling it for real, which appealed to some of my creative sensibilities to go down that route of branding and you know, designing and picking out the bottle and the website and all that stuff. It was very exciting. So that was really when I decided, okay, I'm going to package this. I'm going to think of a name, and I'm going to try to sell this.
Got it.
And Jack Rudy was a natural choice because he was my great-grandfather.
Sorry, I thought it was your grandfather. Screw your great-grandfather. So
yes.
Why name the company after your great-grandfather, or the brand, rather?
Yeah, I grew up hearing about, well, I grew up in a small town in Kentucky. My grandmother lived next door. Our great-grandmother had a sort of a weekend house on, we lived on a farm, and we were around our grandparents all the time, our grandmothers. And they were always telling us, my brothers and I and our cousins, about Jack Rudy, who was had passed away before we were born. And they kind of used him as a barometer for what it meant to be a man, or, you know. So, for example, if we went to their house and our pants were sagging, they would say, pull up your pants. Jack Rudy never would have worn his pants like that. He was a gentleman. He dressed nice. He took care to look nice and button his, you know, shirt up and wear a suit. And he would have had table manners, and he knew how to cut his meat. And, you know, all
so
of these sorts
a
of
mythic
things. Very mythic. Absolutely.
This man that you weren't.
Exactly.
And that most of us aren't.
Well, and when we were young, of course, we were like,
Jack Rudy.
Who cares? I didn't know him, you know. But when you turn, you know, when you become a young adult, you really start to appreciate those lessons and become more aware. And so he was already sort of this mythical gentleman figure. And then he was also, there was this other side of him, this very sort of wild, adventurous side. He was a big drinker. He liked to, he had a bar in his basement of his house.
So many people did in that generation. Like,
which
serious
I loved.
Bars.
Yeah.
Serious bars.
Oh, it was, I mean, not just like a little pop-up bar. It was built,
no,
you know,
like
out of brick.
Bar,
and,
you know,
yeah,
yeah,
it was
like
beautiful.
His own personal tavern downstairs.
Precisely. Yeah. I missed those, or not that I was around, but I'd like to go back to that.
I got nothing like that. I got nothing like that.
Neither do I. I have a small table overflowing with booze, but not can't compare, really. So he was just, you know, he's a wild man. He flew. He was a pilot. He built a houseboat out of a bus. You know, just all sorts of crazy stuff he did. And I thought that was so exciting. And
he needs to have something named after
exactly.
him.
Exactly.
I think I would name my children after him.
Yeah,
it sounds
exactly.
like the kind of guy I wish I'd... Because we don't have role models like that anymore.
We really don't.
That live big.
Mm-hmm.
Big lives.
Yeah.
I don't see it that much anymore.
I agree.
We're too busy. I don't know. Why don't we?
I don't know. Maybe it was just a little easier to, you know, maybe laws were looser then. I mean, he flew his plane under the Ohio River Bridge. Well, if you did that now, it would be on CNN, and someone would have tweeted it, and it would be...
As a pilot, I can tell you that you can legally get away with that in some places.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can. I mean, yeah, it's wild, and it's not completely advisable, but it's doable.
Oh, okay.
You can't do that under the, you know, Brooklyn Bridge,
right.
But you can do it.
You can probably do it under the Ohio River Bridge in Henderson.
Yeah. You can. But it is a little on the wild side.
It was wild. And I don't know, but it's... And
we're
my generation
now.
Has...
Are we too civilized or not civilized enough? Because at one point, he wouldn't wear his pants all baggy and he mm-hmm. wore suits, but he was also a little on the wild side.
Right. Kind of Hemingway-esque.
Hemingway was actually kind of sloppy, though.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I've seen, I'm just thinking of his wild side.
Yeah, thinking about the right. wild side. But those bigger-than-life characters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I want to be like that. Why can't I be like that?
You've got a little bit of that.
Yeah, but society's
you're
different.
You're a pilot.
Now. Society's different now.
Yeah.
You know, different things are expected of us. We have political correctness to deal with, and mm-hmm. we have responsibilities that prevent. And we're both parents. You know, we're supposed to be reasonable people.
Right. That's true.
I don't like it that much. So anyway, I get to live a little wild through what is in the bottle with his name on it, at the very least.
Yes, and I'm hoping that others get to as well. And, you know, we're not going to have a drink and then go fly our planes under any bridges, but maybe...
No, you didn't mention the drinks before the fly.
Right, yeah, that's not advisable at all.
Yeah, the government frowns on that heavily.
They do, I'm sure.
Yeah, for good reason.
But I think maybe, you know, folks can have a drink and maybe... I don't think this will spawn any movement, but I think if people are buying something like Jack Rudy or any of the other great, you know, artisanal small batch spirits in the country that are being made, and they're taking time to make those things at home for mm-hmm. friends and for family, I think it does introduce a little bit more of that kind of sophisticated, civilized, entertaining at home that I think a lot of my generation has lost. So, while I don't think, you know, everyone's running to the store and there'll be this great movement to entertain at home again like Jack Rudy did, I hope that maybe a little bit it does push people to sort of explore and start to make cocktails at home and whatnot.
So the bottle,
mm-hmm.
this is great brown medicine bottle.
Yeah.
Which absolutely hooked me from the second I saw it.
Thank you.
How did that come about?
Well, that was so Jack Rudy was an engineer for his working life, and he invented a machine to count pills for pharmacists. And that was another story, of course, that I had heard about him. So when I decided on the name first, and then I decided that the branding should reflect and the bottle should reflect that era. And because of those ties to a pharmacy and the apothecary culture, I began to look for a bottle that was made sort of called to mind that era. And that was the really, I mean, it was, as soon as I saw it, a bingo moment, I knew that it was perfect.
Yeah. Brown bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Which now, I mean, I can't imagine your product not being in that bottle.
Yeah, it's kind of like the green bottle for Tanqueray. I think we couldn't do it in anything else. It would feel not right.
So how many of these bottles are you cranking out now? What's business like?
We've grown business substantially over the last few years. We're now distributed in 42 states.
Nice.
And we are distributed in Spain, Australia, Canada, and just started distributing to Sweden.
Why
so,
Sweden? Is that a big gin culture? I mean, is it?
I don't know. What I've learned is that the gin and tonic, it really knows no bounds in terms of geography. You know, Spain, it is their number one cocktail, and there are gin and tonic bars.
How do you explain that?
The British, you know, colonial British history would tell you that the Brits would have on board their gin, and then they would have been ingesting their quinine to stave off malaria, and they would have had their limes to combat
scurvy,
exactly. And
gotta,
I think,
have your vitamin C.
That's
why,
you know,
they call them limeys. English lime.
British,
it's from the limes that they made the sailors have in the Navy.
And to fight the scurvy.
Fight scurvy. So
I think that's just to explains a lot that, you know, that naval mm-hmm. sort of introduction of all of, to all of those countries.
But it seems to settle so nicely in hot countries.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the bitterness of the quinine is quite refreshing.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, and that did come out.
And the bubbles.
Of, you know, the Raj and the whole occupation of India. And then where we live in the deep south, where it gets really, really hot. But yeah. Sweden?
True.
Does it ever get hot in Sweden? Does it ever get hot in Sweden? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, I'm looking now for an excuse to go to Sweden now that
you don't need an
we're selling
just
the
go.
Jack Rudy.
You got to go check out
exactly.
The marketplace. Yeah,
precisely.
Which of these areas has surprised you the most?
Australia has picked up very quickly, although that, you know, see, that's hot, that, so that, that makes sense.
It's
I
like
guess.
Hot and formerly British, so mm-hmm. it makes
sense. So it does
sense
make sense.
Yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. yeah, we've had a lot of interest in Japan, and they've got a very vibrant bar culture.
Oh, yeah.
We're not distributed there yet, unfortunately.
Well, see, that's where you need to make the trip to figure that one out.
I would love to. Have you been?
Yes, and the cocktail culture there's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, the precision and the ingredients.
It's incredible. I've seen, you know, watched videos online and seen photos, but I would love to go.
Breathtaking. Expensive.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, London's bar culture is the, you know, the most sort of international bar culture I've really been exposed to in a larger level, and that was pretty fascinating as well. Yeah. But I'll put Tokyo and trip to Japan on the map.
Got to do it. I think, especially, you know, in the business that you're in.
Yeah.
So what's next besides the tonic?
So we, the second product, which we've, you know, is the tonic is really the marquee.
It's your flagship.
It is the flagship, but we produce a grenadine, which was sort of changed again over many years away from its original formula, which was pomegranate based. And so we produce a traditional grenadine with pomegranate juice. And that's to make, you know, everything from your Shirley Temple and your Roy Rogers to very classic drinks like the Monkey Gland, Jack Rose.
Tequila Sunrise.
You know, exactly.
Sure. When you talk about getting away from the original formulas, what was grenadine originally? I mean, it is 100% pomegranate, isn't it? Or is there something else in there?
No, originally it was. But then if you went to the grocery store, let's say 10 years ago, and you looked for a grenadine on the shelf, the one that you would have found would have had high fructose corn syrup, red dye, artificial flavors. So, you know, there was no fruit juice or pomegranate to be found. I mean, it was dyed red to look like it, but that they got away from that original pomegranate formula. So we...
Which is kind of halfway between pomegranate juice and pomegranate molasses,
mm-hmm.
right? Is grenadine.
It is. It's
like
fairly
a reduced,
thick. Yeah.
Syrup of pomegranate. What's the kind of complication or the twist for how you're making it? I mean, I don't imagine you're just buying juice and cooking it down.
No. Well, I mean, we keep it fairly simple. We have orange peel that we use in mm-hmm. that formula. Of course, cane sugar rather than high fructose corn syrup, and then citric acid, which is a preservative, but also provides some, you know, balance to the sweetness.
Sure.
And introduces that acidity.
Yeah,
yeah, that's nice in a drink.
Even.
Exactly.
Yeah. Brightness.
Precisely.
How's that going?
Great. We are, that's funny enough, has really taken off in New York City. We've got some great bars that work with it there. One of my favorite bars in the country, Please Don't Tell. Small speakeasy.
I've been there.
I imagine so.
But we're not going to talk about it.
Great drinks. Let's not.
We're not talking about it.
They have footage.
Yeah, we're not talking about it.
They work with it. The Fedora, which I love, is a little bar in the West Village, and some other of the groups related to Fedora, Joseph Leonard, Montmartre, some of these restaurants owned by this guy named Gabe Stuhlman that are really fun, kind of neighborhood joints. So it's going well, and we're about to introduce our bitters and lime cordial as well.
Tell me about both, because I'm very interested in bitters. Bitters have had such a resurgence in the last really just 3 years, greatly because of, well, a lot of New York bar guys.
Absolutely.
And Los Angeles and a few other places. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of bitters on the market. And for that reason, I never really thought of producing bitters. I said, you know, in my mind, that market was kind of saturated. But then as I took another, well, first of all, a lot of my customers were asking for bitters. And, you know, I didn't want to neglect that opportunity. So when I looked at what bitters were available on the market that are new, I found that most all of these great new bitters producers, they're doing really wonderful things, but they are a little small in scope in terms of the flavor. So, you know, it'll be something like charred pineapple habanero bitters. Well, that's wonderful, and you know it's great with tequila or whatever, but you can't really use a charred pineapple habanero bitters in a lot of drinks. So when I thought, well, what would work with Jack Rudy and what would be delicious, it was sort of a domestic version of Angostura is what we're doing. And that
which is
like
a very classic, straightforward.
Very classic.
Bitters.
You can
not
use it in a Manhattan.
Bitters, not a bottle.
Exactly.
It's the most versatile. And still to this day, if you're going to say you can only have one bottle of bitters,
that's
I
the one.
Bitters,
absolutely.
It's bitters. By definition, mm-hmm. It's bitters.
So we wanted to do something like that, with just as versatile, but just update the formula a little bit. Of course, you know, it's got the Jack Rudy name and our approach, and that's so
which,
that's
again,
the
is going back to originals in a way, better versions of originals,
precisely,
which Jack would have liked.
Uh-huh. He would have co-signed on this, I believe.
Why is it you think that I've always been a very big fan of bitter, mm-hmm. in general. It's like I when no one else my age liked Campari, I was
yeah.
like all about the Campari, and I still
speaking my language. Yeah.
I love a Negroni, and, mm-hmm. and Boulevardier, which of course is basically a Negroni but with bourbon.
Uh-huh.
You know, I love bitter. Why do you think the bitter as a flavor is finally making inroads in America, a culture which typically does not care much for bitter?
Very true. I think you get the proliferation of the cocktail. I think is really has a lot to maybe help with that. You've got these cocktail cultures that were developed in New York City and in San Francisco and Chicago and some of these larger cities. And I think then as food and beverage professionals travel to those cities to go see those places, places like PDT that we mentioned before, they went back to their communities like Charleston, like the Louisville, Kentucky, some smaller markets, and they started making cocktails and in this kind of serious way. And I think that cocktail culture has become so present in a lot of these cities, and a lot of these guys and girls are mixing with things like you mentioned, Campari, with bitters, with these great Amaros, the Fernet Branca, all these great products.
That whole, the Amaros, that's how you say it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Amaros. I've just gotten into in the last year and
yeah.
a half. It's like a whole world.
It really is.
That is,
it's hard to keep up.
Fantastic. And there's
yeah.
so much available.
Mm-hmm.
That I was like, where's this stuff been all my life? Where have I been? I've been living under a rock.
Mm-hmm. It's like you think you've seen it all. And these things have been around
for years, decades,
yeah.
centuries in some
precisely.
Cases.
I mean, these great old Italian producers, and they're just now sort of making inroads in America. And I think because you know we're beginning to embrace some of those bitter liqueurs and spirits and whatnot, and they're really special. And you know, anyone that hasn't tried them, I always encourage to go out because you know it's like when you're. When you try your first beer, maybe you don't like it that much, but you're like, okay, I'm going to have another sip. I'm going to have it, you know, and then you realize that, wow, beer is so refreshing.
So much
and
going on there.
It's so wonderful. And I think Campari's the same way. I remember my mentor liked Campari, and I had never had it before. And when I tried it, of course, I was like, oh my gosh. And, you know, in my head, I'm thinking, there's no way I can drink this. But, you know, drank a whole Campari and soda, and you realize at the end, wow, that is actually beautiful, complex. There's sweetness there. The bitterness is, you know, makes me hungry. It's an appetite sort of stimulant, and then you really begin to see why that's such a popular thing in Italian culture. The aperitivo and the digestivo is such a beautiful thing, and
well, it's part of the meal experience there.
Mm-hmm.
It's they realize that it enhances your juices, you
yeah.
know, and it gets you ready for a meal or brings
right.
you down after one, which we just don't tend to think about.
I've learned that it's very nice to have a little nip after dinner to kind of burn through all of the food you just ate.
I agree. Well, what's your favorite after dinner?
I would say Fernet Branca is
Fernet
one
Branca.
Of my certainly
go-tos.
Just neat. And I sip on it. A lot of people shoot it, which has become sort of this
Fernet
popular
Blanco,
thing.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But I just like
that.
To sip on it. And what I just had yesterday, actually, flew to D.C. and had lunch with some friends of my girlfriend who were born and raised in Palestine, and they cooked this beautiful traditional meal, hummus, baba ganoush, something they called green soup, several things I don't even know how to pronounce. They were stuffed cabbage leaves, stuffed grape leaves, and then at the end we had arak, which is
arak.
Similar to, I don't know, it was anise flavored, and Oh, it was awesome.
And well, after that meal, that's the perfect flavor.
Yeah.
To kind of
compliment
counter all that.
Compliment. It was great. So that, you know, even that was a new experience for me. I hadn't had that. I'd had some, you know, those licorice flavored liqueurs, but I've never had Attic. And now, of course, it's like, well, I'm going to go track down a bottle.
Have some Attic. Yeah, absolutely. It's not an unusual thing to want to have. So now that you've got bitters, you've got the grenadine, you've got the original tonic, where do you see yourself and your company in 5 years?
Great question. I would love to. We're starting to explore producing some bar tools, kind of everyday bar wares for home and restaurant use. We already produce a little wet bar towel, which is sort of an homage to my great grandmother. That's produced in Alabama in collaboration with a great company there called Alabama Channon, and that's made from cotton. This is very kind of simple bar towel, but really beautiful. I use them at home. And then we would like to get into some bar tools, you know, producing spoons and shakers and jiggers and strainers and the kind of things that a beginning cocktail enthusiast would want for their home. And then pipe dream type stuff. I would love one day to get into producing gin. That would be very exciting for me. Of course, there are, you know, that's costly and requires much more, you know, approvals. And when you're dealing with alcohol, of course, that is a complicated process.
Just wait for one of the other houses to start to go under and buy it.
There you go. That's what you do. I would love to be in that position.
You just wait on the side until some little place that's already done all that runs out of
steam.
Has it
in place.
And then you swoop in and make it your own. That's what I would do, because there have been so many of them.
Yeah.
They can't all last.
You're exactly right, I think.
What would you do with a gin?
Well, I do have one small thing, and I don't know if I would want to say what it is out loud.
Don't give it away. Do not give away secrets.
No, I won't, but I'll tell you, I can at least give a hint without that won't reveal anything. But there was something that grew on our farm, and on the back of our farm, these plants grew. And this is a common, well-known thing. And so I always thought if we produce a gin, we're going to use what grew on our farm, not necessarily sourced from our farm because it's growing wild, but use that as a botanical in a gin to make it kind of this southern style.
Let's see, it could
dry
be berries. There could be a honeysuckle. It grows on a back fence. Muscadines, that probably wouldn't be good in gin. You know, sumac, it could only have to be Middle Eastern sumac. You can use.
Does sumac grow here?
It does, but it's the poison, the kind.
Oh.
The sumac that you aromatics, it's only Middle Eastern. See, kudzu
I could see
flowers,
that being very good flowers. In gin, but it was not that.
Well,
but
not,
those
gonna,
are
I'm
all
gonna,
very,
I'm
very
trying.
Good.
I'm
yeah.
Trying. I'm going to keep trying. Doesn't matter.
So yeah. We'll see. 5-10 years, maybe that is a possibility. I'd love to see it happen.
Any desire to own a bar?
Absolutely. Well, I'm actually I am in the restaurant business. I'm about to open a restaurant in about a month. Funny enough, we're not serving booze. It's just beer and wine only. So I would love to one day have a cocktail bar. And in fact, we would call it Jack's. And I have this great photo, which is on our website, of Jack Rudy and his wife, Mary. And they're at Pat O'Brien's in New Orleans drinking Hurricanes. And I would have that printed black and white, framed, and that
big.
Would... you know, be on the back bar lit with a museum light kind of over it. I see it being this very sort of sultry, you know, dark woods, very kind of old school leather Hollywood booth kind of place. I would love to do that. Never say never.
Give me a call when it's time for investors, because I've done that too.
Fair enough.
Very, very, very much. So right now, I mean, a lot of people that are going to be hearing this are immediately going to want to latch on to some tonic. What's the best way to get hold of it?
Well,
I mean, I know that it's like where I live in Atlanta, you can buy it places. Mm-hmm. It's available a few places.
Exactly.
But you can also get it online, right?
Yeah, we sell it through our website, which is jackrudycocktailco.com.
Okay.
And that's, I think, the easiest way. And then, of course, we have a little map on the, you know, if somebody prefers to maybe support one of their smaller local vendors that sells it, we have a map on the website. I think it's under a tab that says Find. And while I haven't done the best job of keeping it updated, it does have a breakdown of state by state where it can be purchased.
I think you ought to either make or buy and sell or direct people towards good seltzer siphons.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because
that is a great point.
I actually, that's what I use when I make your gin
and
tonics. Because I don't like buying carbonated water. I have this beautiful old siphon, you know,
old school siphon
with the CO2 chargers, you know, that I make my own. It keeps for a really long time. You know, with the metal mesh around the bottles and you, shoot that in to the glass. You should turn people onto those.
You're because, so right.
You know, you sell a product that, I mean, one bottle, when you buy one of these bottles, folks, it looks like, oh my gosh, this isn't going to go very far. Because how many ounces? It's a 17 ounce bottle. Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay, a little more than a pint. So it's a 17 ounce bottle, and it doesn't look like it's going to go very far. You start making cocktails and realize, wow, I'm really doing this a jigger at a time, and it works.
It stretches
very, very well.
Yeah,
and you know it's funny. Their kids like it.
Yeah,
I've made it with juice. I've mixed some with like cranberry juice.
Yeah.
To make a cocktail. You know, to make my own riff on a Shirley Temple, mm-hmm. and I found kids dig it.
Yeah.
But it really does go a long way, and so I think it's actually the perfect thing to order online if you don't have a small purveyor near you, because it's small, you ship it doesn't break or anything. But that with a soda siphon, and you've got yourself an entire summer's worth of great drinks.
I need to sell soda siphons on the website. That is a great idea.
The great thing to have, you know. Whenever I was mixing with your stuff, I never opened a bottle of club soda. I always use a siphon.
And it lasts then. I mean, the carbonation level's a little different,
you know, but I find it more, I use two chargers because I like mine a little on the bubbly side. Uh-huh. I like that fizz in my nose. But I really think it lets the flavor come through.
Yeah, that's great.
So let me get on.
You just became an unofficial Jack Rudy advisor, my friend.
Can I see you on the board? Right. What do you think that the cocktail culture that certainly, it's funny how things jump generations. You're younger than me, probably by a generation. I'm 50. What are you?
About to turn 30.
Okay,
this
so
year.
You're two generations mm-hmm. under me. My grandparents. And even my parents, it's funny, I remember so vividly. I was actually born in Los Angeles, and my father worked for NBC as an account executive, and more than a few times did a lot of entertaining at our little house in North Hollywood, mm-hmm. and very often had famous TV people, like the Gabor sisters, and people would come to these parties at my parents' house. And I would at night get down on the floor of my room and scoot up next to the crack at the bottom of the door so that I could listen to cocktail parties and the sound of women laughing when they'd had a little bit too much drink and the sound of a cocktail shaker and just the adult vibe of what that culture was like. And then when I got older, old enough, it was gone. There was no, you know, I graduated from high school in 1979 and so, you know, basically learned how to drink in the 80s mm-hmm. when the cocktail was dead.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no cocktail. I mean, other than something that somebody put together in a trash can at a frat party,
right.
You drank beer. Or you drank beer, you drank wine. And then in my own case, I had a stepfather who taught me about bourbon and spirits. And then I remember having my first real martini as an adult, you know, only having thought, oh my, this is quaint. You know, this is so very Rat Pack, whatever.
Yeah.
And I had it and was like, wait a second, there's a lot going on here. This is nothing but good gin and vermouth, really? That's all that's going. And then, but your culture, your generation, why is it your people, I don't want to get into the whole hipster thing, but have embraced cocktails from not just a we're going to get drunk and throw up aspect, but we're going to actually enjoy this as a culinary expression. Why do you think that happened?
You know, I think, interestingly enough, because you were, of course, still are part of Food Network. I think my generation grew up watching our parents watching and I was watching Food Network. I mean, this would be when I was, you know, more like 12, mm-hmm. I think, you know, 12 to 18. And
middle school to high school.
Mm-hmm. And so we became, and I became very aware of food and you know, drink was less prominent on the Food Network, but
yeah, well,
the food culture, yeah, I mean, it's a family friendly, you know, network, I'm sure. But unlike maybe when you were growing up or when my parents were growing up, you know, when of course there was Julia Childs and whatnot, but I think the Food Network and food magazines, you know,
food media in general,
exactly, the food media just really made me and I think people my age more aware of that can be such an exciting culture and that can be a certifiable profession that you enter. So I think that has a lot to do with it. And just the food media, you know, helping somebody like me be aware of what's happening in New York in the food and the cocktail world and what's happening in San Francisco. And there's just been an ability to sort of see what's happening across the globe. And I think that has informed our desire to have nice cocktails and think more about where we go out to eat. I mean, it's crazy the amount of, you know, people my age that are going out to eat every meal and are going to some really great places and spending a lot of their income on food and beverage.
I find that there are a lot of young people that are spending a great deal of time out. They're developing very sophisticated palates, but I don't know about their cooking skills. I don't know about, I still don't think we've really made it back to even where we were in the 60s with home entertaining.
I agree.
And I think that part of that is because we've forgotten something about hospitality. I think that in the 50s and 60s, even back in the 40s, Jack's time, Jack Reed's time, home entertaining was not about going out and finding scary recipes from some big TV chef and creating them for people and like this big intimidation thing.
Yeah.
It was more about we're going to have fun. I mean, I remember at my parents' house, they would have cocktails and somebody would just make a pot of chili. I mean, it was more about people.
Yeah.
And it was more about the interaction of people than it was, okay, well, what I've made for you is an arugula la 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 with a blah, 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 blah. The pretension that often comes with home cooking.
So absolutely.
I know young people your age in New York that can, you know, sit down and have a paella and differentiate between different types of saffron, but still can't cook a steak.
Right. That is unfortunate.
And I don't know what the disconnect is. I don't know why that is. But one of the reasons that I like the cocktail cultures is I believe the cocktail mixing is cooking. Okay, very often no heat is applied. Sometimes it is, but not always. But that the sensitivity that one has to pay to your palate and paying attention to flavors and aromas requires you really using your sensory apparatus, which is, I think, a big part of it.
Yeah. So. And it's like baking in a way, you know, measuring and a quarter ounce too much of Campari could throw off a drink, you know, the balance of a drink pretty substantially. Well, that's interesting what you say about cooking. I feel the same way, and I love to cook at home, but I find that not a lot of my friends cook at home. If we are going to meet up for dinner, it's often that we're going to go out, and what I found is the most memorable nights are spent at home, you know, and that can be just a big bowl of salad, you know, and a roasted chicken, and it doesn't get any simpler than those. Well, a roasted chicken can be very easy to screw up as well, but you know,
simple isn't always
that's
easy.
All you need at the end of the day, and a nice bottle of wine, some drinks, and some good tunes on the speakers, and that really makes for a special night. And we, you know, I would love to see a return to that and a little more embrace of that, maybe just among sort of my peers.
You know, it's funny that you talk about the tunes on the speakers. I think about the fact that we trivialize a lot in this day and age. I've tried to awaken in my daughter at least an appreciation for what it is to take a vinyl LP and put on a turntable and make her understand that there was a time, certainly in the 70s, when you would sit down and spend an entire afternoon just reading liner notes and listening and turning the record and listening again, that you focused. And we don't focus much anymore. We're constantly, I mean, luckily neither you or I have checked our phones during this period, but our attention is so split. Our attention spans get shorter and shorter. And sometimes I think that a cocktail, especially a challenging cocktail, snaps the focus and pulls you in and wakes you up. It's literally like getting slapped across the face.
Yeah.
And said, whoa, pay attention to this for a second, which is actually kind of a really good and interesting thing because we need that slap occasionally.
Absolutely.
Because
agree.
We get in this haze, this fog of gibberish, actually, like electronic gibberish that is life now or passes for life. And you get, you know, a little concoction in a glass that all of a sudden has 15 different things going on. And as you taste it, it changes in your mouth. And as the temperature changes, all of a sudden your world gets real small. And it's about you and that glass.
That's a beautiful thing.
I like it. But I think that's part of what makes it work now. I mean, part of why people crave these things is because they want something
to
take
slow
their
down
attention
a little bit.
It stops time a little bit. You know, it's like a great kiss. It's like, okay, there's a kiss and then there's a kiss. And, you know, being able to have something that really, you know, kind of punches your senses awake is a good thing.
Absolutely agree.
We don't get it very often.
Yeah.
I think.
How old is your daughter?
Daughter's 14.
Yeah. So do you have records at the house that she listens to?
She's still, you know, she is still a song by song kind of girl. The concept of listening to an album
is foreign to many.
I still can't get her. She understands it. She doesn't value it yet. But then why do I value it? Well, I value it, number one, because it's nostalgic. But number two, because I just have always seen music as something that songs come in sets and they're designed to go together.
It's like a film. There's a statement that a whole album makes.
You can't say, well, I like this scene from this movie and this scene from this movie.
And cobble them together, right?
My parents owned a radio station when I was a kid, and I very, very strongly remember the day that I was sitting in my room with my little portable turntable, and my dad walked in the room with a sample. You know, you got free records.
Yeah.
And it was a record that had not come out yet. And he didn't say a word. And he came in and he handed this record to me and he turned and he walked out. And I looked at it and it was this really funky album. It was called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And I didn't come out of my room for 6 months.
That's amazing. I love it.
And it hadn't come out yet.
Yeah.
And I listened to it and I flipped it and I listened to it and I flipped it and listened to it. And to this day, the experience of that, beyond the music itself, okay, everybody knows the music, blah, blah, blah. But the experience of the album.
Well, and as you said, the minor notes,
every word, every picture, everything.
That album cover, just getting lost in that album cover and all those faces and all the crazy stuff happening, that's a beautiful story. And I can relate because, of course, you were hearing that album when the Beatles were producing it, but my dad is a huge music fan and has a monstrous vinyl collection. So I almost had musically the childhood of someone 20 years my senior, because I would sit, you know, my brothers would do the same. We would sit in the living room where my dad had his turntable and we would put on the Beatles or James Taylor or Tom Petty or all these great records that my dad had, and we would, you know, sing along, reading the lyrics.
Sheets, yeah, like that.
And so I have a huge soft spot in my heart for the vinyl days, for sure.
What kind of stuff do you listen to at home?
You know, I listen to a lot of old music. I love old soul music. I like Sam Cooke when he was singing with the Soul Stirrers is one of my favorite. I mean, that I go back to that all the time. Of course, I love the Beatles, but you can't find, you know, that's the beauty of the Beatles is their catalog is not available through all these streaming services, you know, so you have to go back and get the full album.
Yeah.
I love a lot of, you know, I grew up in the hip hop era. So I have a lot of, you know, hip hop, Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and Far Side. I grew up with a lot of that stuff. And, Dr. Dog is one of my favorite bands.
I wouldn't have figured you for Dr. Dog, but all right, I like that. All right. I'll go there.
Big music fan. Yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Dog. Okay. I'll go there. Completely go there. I like that actually.
In fact, the restaurant, so the opening restaurant in about a month, it's called Leon's, it's going to be downtown Charleston, and we decided that music was going to be an important element of the experience. And we were in New Orleans doing some sort of just R&B research and ideating in New Orleans over many drinks, and Ernie K. Doe, this old soul artist, came on the radio.
I don't even think I know Ernie K. Doe.
His hit was Mother-in-Law. And
it's a
great tune. And it came on the radio, or no, on the jukebox. We were in a bar in the French Quarter. It came on the jukebox, and I said to my partner, I said, this song is the mood that the restaurant should be. It's a very kind of light, fun, breezy song, despite the name.
The Mother-in-Law.
Yeah. And from there, we kind of really decided music was going to be a big part. So we bought a lot of Ernie K. Doe's work. We bought 250 different albums from sort of quintessential jazz soul artists, and we've, you know, invested in this great sound system, and we actually had a mural painted of Ernie K. Doe, which is on the back wall of the restaurant.
Nice. Can't wait to see that.
So there is a music and food often. I feel like you know, musicians and chefs often have this sort of respect for one another there.
Indeed.
But it's interesting, the intersection.
Brooks, thanks for being on the show.
It's been a blast.
Appreciate it. Good luck with the bar and the new products.
Thank you very much.
I think you're onto something.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
Pleasure. That's it for this week's Alton Browncast. Until next time, America, cook smart.